Well, it's time for a bit of changing Australia now. And as the COVID pandemic bore down on Australia and many Australians looked to experts for answers, one voice and name you might remember is Professor Sharon Lewin. But Sharon's work stretches far beyond COVID. A globally recognised infectious disease specialist, she is among those searching for a cure globally for HIV. She's also at the helm of a national network for pandemic preparedness and is the inaugural director at the Doherty Institute, which works to prevent, treat and cure infectious diseases. Very pleased to say that Sharon Lewin is my guest this morning on Changing Australia. Sharon, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Sally. Good to be here.
Now, I'm one of the many journalists who spent quite a bit of time talking to you during the pandemic. I wanted to know, to go back a lot further, though, for you, what was behind your choice to be working in infectious diseases?
Well, my interest in infectious diseases actually dates back to 1989. I was a young doctor. I had just had 2 years under my belt, and I spent a year working in Kenya in a remote hospital just near the foot of Mount Kenya. I don't know, probably, you know, a crazy dream of a young doctor. And while there, I became aware of the scale of HIV. It was just really unfolding in Africa. There were, at the time, probably many, many people infected, not yet sick. And I think over that year, I learnt a lot about myself. I was probably not the doctor to be at the front line in a rural hospital in remote Kenya, but I did want to have a global impact in the work that I did. And HIV at that time had no treatment, you know, universal death sentence to young people, incredibly traumatic, stigmatizing infectious disease. And I spent a lot of time working on it since then.
Is there an element of detective work in working in infectious disease medicine?
Yeah, there is, especially in those early days when a new infectious disease appears and we know nothing about it. I wasn't there at the very early days of HIV. That was 1981. I was a first-year medical student at Monash University in Melbourne. We didn't even know it existed at that time. But as you, that very early phase, and we experienced it in COVID, but I think what was interesting in COVID, it was sped up 1,000 times.
Compressed, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was very compressed because of the nature of the illness, because of the scale, but also because of the technologies we now have, which we didn't have, of course, in the early 80s.
How do you see the collision between politics and medicine when it comes to pandemics? So in those late 80s, as you're saying, it was a death sentence for many people, particularly in Africa with HIV. By the time we got to the early 2000s, antiretroviral medication was available, but we know that in many parts of Africa, and particularly South Africa, people who were sick and dying actually had to take their own government to court to get that treatment. And we saw politics collide with medicine in the pandemic as well. What's that like when you're working as a medical professional?
Well, I think it can be an extremely productive relationship too. And there's no doubt that infectious diseases that affect populations are not just an individual. You need a multifaceted response to it. And it's not only political leadership that you need, you also need a community engagement. I think I got trained in an environment, you know, HIV was quite unique in how it brought together community. I mean, community activism starting with gay rights in, you know, the Western world, but now continuing with activism in all across the world, and particularly sub-Saharan Africa, was a major propellant to doing things. And, you know, people forget in the early days of HIV, no one wanted to talk about it. It was a population of people that we didn't even really understand, the gay community back then, and no one wanted to talk about it. So the activism of community was essential. Political leadership also essential, and political leadership can do some great things, as we actually saw here in Australia in the early days of HIV. The Australian government had an incredibly progressive, bipartisan, very impressive response to HIV that we all should still be very proud of.
How much of a wild card in the middle of all this science is human behaviour and stigma when it comes to things like HIV?
Absolutely central. and central actually to really many infectious diseases. If I just reflect on HIV, incredibly enough, you know, 40 years later, stigma still exists. It's got better, of course, in a country like Australia. It's got better because we have excellent treatments now for HIV, and when people take those treatments, they can live normal, healthy lives and are no longer infectious. But still there's a lot of shame associated with HIV, largely because of how it's transmitted, you know, sex and drugs. People don't want to talk about that. And in many parts of the world, even, you know, I'm stunned when I go to South Africa, where in some parts of South Africa, you know, 40% of young women between the age of 18 to 24 are living with HIV. So it's really common, you know, close to one in two, and yet it's still very stigmatised. And so we've got a lot of work still to do on that.
I remember working with some South African colleagues when I was based there, two young black South African guys who, if we'd go and film an AIDS story, didn't want to touch anything. They'd refuse to drink tea or eat biscuits. They hated going on those stories. And subsequently, it was clear that although they didn't know at the time, they themselves were already infected with HIV and unfortunately died of AIDS. That fear at the time in the early 2000s, the stigma and misinformation was huge, Sharon.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story. And that, of course, in the early 80s, we didn't have anything like social media and the ability to access misinformation. And a lot of fear and hysteria, and I actually felt this in the early days of COVID, is often due to lack of understanding or, you know, and as we get more facts, as we understand what where you are and you aren't at risk, it's really important that those facts are really understandable by communities so that we can, you know, the thing like, you know, getting HIV from a cup of tea, impossible, never even contemplated it, but somehow people believed that or still believe it.
Yeah, it is interesting. So where are we at globally, Sharon, when it comes to efforts to try and find a cure to HIV? Because I think with antiretroviral medication for AIDS, a lot of people have kind of been looking the other way and thinking, oh, that problem's sorted.
Well, it's an interesting time for around the science in finding a cure for HIV. And if I just step back for a moment, as I mentioned, there are excellent treatments for HIV, what we call antiretroviral therapy. Antiretroviral therapy restores health, reduces, eliminates the chance of transmission and is widely available in a country like Australia and actually widely, you know, not perfect, but over 70% of people
much
living
better
with HIV can access antiretrovirals around the world. Some countries doing brilliantly, even in sub-Saharan Africa. But the catch with antiretroviral therapy, as miraculous as it is that you need to take it lifelong. And as soon as you stop those drugs, usually within 2 to 3 weeks, the virus comes bouncing back. And that's because the virus, HIV, is a very clever virus and it has this ability to go into a silent sleeping form. And so for many years, people have thought, you know, can we ever eliminate that silent sleeping form of HIV? Can we boost a person's immune system so that they can control the virus on their own? And in the last, the last 15 years or so, we've learnt curing HIV is possible. It's very rare, but there are 10 people around the world who have been cured of HIV following a bone marrow transplant, which they received for a blood cancer, not because of the HIV. And those sleeping cells could be eliminated. So that's given people a lot of hope that this is possible. And in the last few years, we've learnt in clinical trials, in animal models, that you really can modify the immune response to the virus. And in some people, that allows control. Early days, much more work to be done. But I do think this will be possible.
What will that mean globally for HIV and AIDS if we can crack this?
Well, at the moment, if the goal is to treat at least 95% of people living with HIV, I mentioned we're sitting at around 70-75%. The cost of that, even with cheap and what we call generic drugs, off-label drugs that are available to people in low- and middle-income countries, and on average, treatment for HIV costs about $100 a year in a low- and middle-income country. But to put 95% of the world's people living with HIV on treatment costs about $30 billion a year. So imagine if we could find a way that people did not need lifelong treatment. That would be a tremendous relief for individual. We know that from lots of surveys we've done of people living with HIV in all parts of the world. But it would free up an incredible amount of funding to do other things. I should also say that the big advances in HIV right now in access to treatment have very much depended on the US government that have provided an incredible amount of funding. And, of course, that's we've now realised is not a given. There's been a lot of disruption in that area, many people around the world losing access to treatment. So we need a more, my view, and many others believe that we need a more permanent solution here.
What was it like being in the middle, as an expert, being in the middle of the COVID pandemic with misinformation? There were very strong views about COVID and the way to approach it, and a trust was a big issue and distrust. As an expert who was being interviewed quite frequently at that time, was there much abuse directed towards you? Were you targeted during that?
Actually, amazingly enough, I did not have much abuse. There was a little bit on social media, but I tended not to look. My husband used to forensically monitor it. I never looked at it. I think there were different phases in COVID. You know, if you think back to that first phase in 2020 when we knew very little about COVID, in Australia, people really listened and I think trusted what they were being asked to do. And it was a somewhat scary time, although I must admit I always felt reassured that science would deliver some solutions. And, of course, the trust and conversation got more tricky as time went on for a whole range of reasons. But I think one thing I'd like people to reflect on is actually Australia did remarkably well in COVID. If you look at lives saved, dramatically fewer deaths than many other countries. And we shouldn't forget how much death and suffering there was in those first few months in countries that didn't respond quickly and decisively as we did here.
Sharon, just finally, if I may, you know, taking on particularly something like HIV, that it almost feels like there must be a deep underlying optimism to try and take on these viruses and think that there might be something that can be done. Your parents came to Australia after World War II. Your dad was a survivor of the Holocaust. Your mum was evacuated from Poland to Siberia during the war. How did their resilience and their outlook on life here in Australia affect your own, both professionally and personally, do you think?
Oh, I think it had a big effect. First of all, education is incredibly important to Jewish people, and particularly for migrants, because education is your sort of ticket to integration into your host country. So my parents were essentially robbed of an education because all that you were describing was happening when they were young adults. So they were very, very strong on education. I became a doctor, my brother an orthodontist, my sister a lawyer, so they sort of had the trifecta. They were very, you know, very hardworking. And they also really, really loved Australia. You know, Australia was a paradise for my parents and for so many people that came here at that time and continues to be a paradise for people that leave very distressing circumstances. So, you know, they just felt a very strong strong work ethic, a strong sense of giving back, a strong sense of, you know, you can make the world a better place.
Sharon, it's been so fascinating to have a chat with you more broadly than the daily news, which we've done so many times. Thank you for sharing some details of your work and also sharing some of your own story as well. I'm very appreciative. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Sally.
Professor Sharon Lewin there, the inaugural director at the Doherty Institute and chief investigator at the Australian Partnership for Preparedness Research on Infectious Diseases Emergencies.